Chapter 10, The Industrial Transition. In the years after Reconstruction, many North Carolinians saw things happen they thought would never come true in their state. African American men, for example, continued to vote and have a voice in state government despite white resentment. One black leader, George H. White of New Bern, served the state for 25 years. The Bladen County native graduated from Howard University in Washington, D.C. After the Civil War, he became a school principal, then was one of the state's first African American lawyers. 3 times, White won election to represent North Carolinians in the United States Congress. Just as startling to some traditional North Carolinians was the achievement of a woman. Annie Lowry Alexander became the very first licensed female physician in the state. Miss Alexander, the great-granddaughter of educator David Caldwell, grew up in Mecklenburg County. She was homeschooled by her father and attended the Women's Medical College in Philadelphia. She graduated in 1884 and in 1885 took her medical examination with 99 men. She earned the highest grade. Dr. Alexander practiced medicine from her home in Charlotte until she died in 1929. She focused her career on making women and young children in her hometown healthier. She promoted physical education for everyone and provided free health care at nearby orphanages. Although she was well respected, she could only become an honorary member of the North Carolina Medical Society because only men were supposed to be members at that time. Change was happening all over North Carolina in the 1880s and 1890s. Trains connected state residents directly and speedily to the outside world. For the first time, towns grew steadily and prospered. In contrast, long-established farming neighborhoods went through hard times, and farm families were forced to change their habits. Some families, white and black alike, even lost their farms. The transformation from isolated neighborhoods to a fully engaged industrial state in the Union was at hand. Section 1. Railroads lead to town growth. As you read, look for how North Carolina began the transition into an industrial state, the growth of cities and towns, the start of North Carolina's furniture industry, and the following term, transition. Most of North Carolina's towns grew rapidly after Reconstruction. During the Civil War, only Wilmington had more than 10,000 people and seemed big enough to be a city. 40 years later, at the start of the 20th century, a much bigger Wilmington, with 20,000 people, remained the state's largest town and most important seaport. But it was no longer the only town in the process of becoming a city. Charlotte, Winston, soon to combine with nearby Salem, and Asheville all rivaled, compared with, Wilmington in size. The growth of these western towns was evidence that North Carolina was in a time of transition, the beginning of important and long-lasting change. Reasons for the transition. Why had this happened? There were 2 reasons. First, the railroads the Republicans restored during Reconstruction finally connected North Carolina with the outside world. For the first time in state history, North Carolinians could trade easily and cheaply with other states and nations. By the 1890s, railroads had been completed from the coast at Beaufort through the mountains all the way to Murphy, the state's westernmost town. In all, more than 3,600 miles of track had been laid or repaired since the war. By 1890, North Carolina was connected in every direction to railroads in the rest of the United States. Because of the railroad, people all over the state began to grow or gather every type of product they could find that someone somewhere in the world would buy. For example, folks in the mountains picked tons of blackberries and dried them. Merchants in towns like Statesville and Marion shipped them to Montana for ranchers to eat. Down east, farmers near Wilmington grew strawberries. Each spring, trains took the berries, which sat in baskets on ice, to Philadelphia and New York within 2 days of their picking. This type of trade encouraged the growth of towns along the railroads because it was not practical for the train to stop at every farm along the way. Second, North Carolinians quickly learned after Reconstruction, that if they processed their raw materials into finished products, for example, tobacco into cigarettes and cotton into cloth, the price they received would increase. This idea encouraged the leading merchants to invest their store profits into factories, where hired workers turned raw materials into consumer goods. Most of the first factory workers were native North Carolinians who had moved off their farms and into town. This movement continued to swell the size of communities. Thus, during the late 1880s, North Carolina went through what one schoolteacher of the day called the Industrial Transition, a time of change that was making it into a new type of state. By 1900, it was becoming the most industrial state in the South. Although it did not have nearly as many factories as most northern states, it increasingly depended upon manufacturing to provide jobs for its citizens. Concord, an industrial town. Concord was a case in point. At the time of the Civil War, Concord had fewer than 1,000 people. Its one factory made everything from nails to cotton yarn to burlap bags, but it seldom made a profit. Concord shipped what it could by slow wagon to distant seaports. Once the North Carolina Railroad was restored after the Civil War, nearby farmers began to grow a lot of cotton, and the cotton factory was revived. By the 1890s, Concord had a half-dozen cotton mills. Farmers came from more than 50 miles to sell their cotton, vegetables, and fruits. By 1900, more than 4,000 people lived in Concord. Most of them were connected to the new industrial work. Concord looked just like every other industrial town in the state. Its downtown was a cluster of brick buildings that housed stores, hotels, and churches. On the main streets that radiated out from downtown lived the richer families who owned the stores or served the churches and schools. Their houses were generally full of fancy furniture and other items brought from the north by train. On one end of town lived African Americans in a separate neighborhood. On the other end of town was the Mill Village, another new form of living in North Carolina, where factory workers lived in houses rented from the factory owners. In towns like Concord, black laborers and white millhands had their own separate schools, churches, and stores. New towns on the railroads. North Carolinians even built new towns during this period. High Point had begun as a depot on the North Carolina Railroad in 1854. It became a key trading spot after the plank road from Salem to Fayetteville was completed. Soon merchants clustered their stores along the plank road. By the 1890s, leading families started furniture factories there to make use of the wood being brought in by farmers from the nearby Uwharries. Burlington started out as a sidetrack called Company Shops, where the North Carolina Railroad had its repair yards. Depots also drove the development of Gastonia, Durham, and Hickory. Each of these locations grew from a mere hamlet, small settlement, to a thriving industrial town within 30 years. Hickory, for example, had a depot, a tavern, 5 stores, a church, and a few houses in 1865. In 1900, the town contained a dozen churches, more than 50 stores, 6 hotels, and 20 factories. The development of new towns hurt the growth of older towns that were not as well connected to the railroads. Burlington, for example, soon overshadowed nearby Graham. By 1900, Gastonia had stopped the growth of Dallas. The same was true when the railroad from Winston was laid on the other side of the Yadkin River from Wilkesboro. North Wilkesboro was the result. The rise of Charlotte. The largest shift in size in the western half of the state came in the comparative importance of Charlotte and Salisbury. At the start of the Civil War, the two towns were fairly equal in size and level of economic activity. After the war, however, Salisbury did not get as many railroads as Charlotte. Barely 2,000 people lived in the Mecklenburg County seat in 1860. By 1900, Charlotte had become the intersection of railroads coming from 6 directions and had grown to have 18,000 people. Salisbury, with 6,000 people, was not much more than twice as large as it had been in 1860, when it had the same 2 railroads. In every town that was growing, factories were as important as trains to the process of development. Soon after Company Shops, for example, got a Coffin factory in 1884, it assumed its new name, Burlington. Some towns like Durham, Winston, and Concord got so many important factories that they became known as mill towns. Special feature, growing up in a cotton mill. The early cotton mills of North Carolina were always full of young people. The mills built before the Civil War hired mostly young women because young men could easily make more money working on a farm. At Cedar Falls in Randolph County, as many as 2/3 of the workforce were young women in their teens or 20s. Occasionally, a young boy was hired at the factory If he worked hard, the owners might train him to be a boss. William H. Branson became an orphan at age 12 in the 1860s. This son of a blacksmith worked his way up at Cedar Falls. He then went to Durham and helped Julian S. Carr, the owner of Bull Durham Tobacco, start that city's first cotton mill. Today, there is a Branson Hall at Duke University named in his honor. The decline of farming after Reconstruction left young men with fewer opportunities. Thousands of young men came with their families to the factories in towns like Concord and Gastonia. By the 1890s, the majority of the cotton mill workers in the state were male. Their average age was about 20. Some were mere boys. By 1900, child labor was used in just about every cotton mill in the state. For example, more than 100 children went to work every day for 12 hours at a time in the Odell Mills in Concord. Boys as young as 8 were doffers who took the filled bobbins of yarn off their pipes and replaced them with empty bobbins. Young girls tended to be spinners. Their main task was to reach into the machines and twist together broken pieces of yarn. It was not physically demanding, as one worker remembered. It was just drudgery. To deal with the long hours, some young girls in the Odell Mills played games with one another when their boss was not watching. Minnie Scarborough, who was 10 at the time, took old bags and cut out paper dolls with scissors used for trimming the yarn. She traded dolls with her friends at nearby machines. One day, they were caught by their boss, a gruff old man. After the boss cursed us, Minnie went home crying. When Mr. Odell learned what had happened, he threw the boss's toolkit out of the window of the mill and fired him. Most of the children had to work because the mill paid so little that only a family wage could pay the bills. Children were not even paid directly. The money they earned was given to their parents. Many child laborers only went to school for brief periods. In some families, it was assumed that schooling ended with the teenage years and work began. North Carolina passed laws to restrict the use of child labor in 1913. The state also passed compulsory education laws to make children go to school. Yet many mills ignored the laws, and there were very few state officials around to enforce them.